a lot of employees feel the exact same way within their company. Everybody has that reason why they don't tell the company the truth. They don't trust the company. Or like, hey, I just bought my house. I'm not trying to lose my job. I just put my kid in private school. Oh, I'm a woman. I'm just got an initial role. And I'm the first woman, so I don't want to mess it up for someone else. And those are the things that, you know, people deal with on a daily basis. And I wanted them to have a safe place to where they could come and have these conversations about the workplace without all this fear of backlash or judgment.
Hey, it's Adam Schoenfeld. Welcome back to the Built in Seattle podcast, where Seattle's top entrepreneurs, investors, and leaders share their stories and their lessons from behind the scenes. If you like this show, then you'll love my short weekly email, the Pike Street Journal. Subscribe at psj.email. Each week I send some bonus nuggets from these interviews, stuff I get when the recorder's off, and some more insider takes on Seattle people and companies. That's psj.email. On this episode, I talked with Sydney James. He's the founder of In Your. They help employees anonymously talk about racism, fear, or other big issues at work. The idea came from his experience with discrimination when applying to tech jobs. He shared his story, some of the surprises and learnings from his user research, and how he's launching his startup. I hope you enjoy the conversation. I'm here with the one, the only, Sydney James. Hey, Sydney, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for having me.
Good to talk with you. We connected through your work at Seattle Academy several years ago now. I was excited to see you go from the teaching world into entrepreneurship.
Yeah, it's been very interesting. A lot of the things you do in teaching, it really kind of helps you prepare for entrepreneurship. I'm dealing with a lot of managing people, understanding and being flexible, and then having that capacity to really have a strong hold on the actual topic. So you become this master at this one particular topic, and now you're teaching others to do it. So it basically enhances your capabilities as well too. And so that's what kind of made the transition a lot similar. So it wasn't as difficult as one would think to go from teaching to entrepreneurship. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs have some type of teaching background. When you look at the really successful one, they actually come from like academic, or they go back to academic and go in and become an adjunct professor or teach all these classes because they have all these expertise. So I feel like it's a really good segue to go from teaching to entrepreneurship.
Was that something that surprised you when you made the transition, or were you already seeing that angle as a teacher that might be a path forward for you?
Teaching, I really enjoy helping people in general. So that's where that came from. And then it provides you with a lot of flexibility that you wouldn't have in a traditional 9-to-5, say at a Microsoft or Amazon, where you always own. With teaching, you kind of have this structure to where you know what your everyday life is going to look like. And it provides you the ability to manipulate the schedule into your advantage. And so I was not necessarily surprised, but once I figured out I had all this downtime, I knew I had this burning entrepreneur desire. So I said, okay, so let me see, how can I plug in some of this passion into my daily life as opposed to doing something else? And so that's kind of how it was kind of structured that way.
Love that. I hadn't thought about that, but it totally makes sense because it gives you that space to kind of control and think about things. So I want to go back and I want to talk about the experience that you had after your MBA when you were applying to jobs in Seattle. Can you share what happened at that time?
Yeah. So, you know, I was thinking the world was going to be my oyster. I can get any job I want. And, you know, I had all this academic success. And then I started applying for these jobs. I'm like, okay, I'm getting rejected from every job that you can imagine, even free internships. I'm like, wait a minute. I'm trying to work for free and you telling me I can't? And so I was just so happened to just be talking to a friend here. And as I'm sharing my story, he goes like, hey, like, are you putting your race down when you apply for these roles? And I'm thinking, yeah, like, everybody's looking for, you know, diverse candidates and all these things. So if anything, this should only help me, not so hurt me. And so as we having this conversation, he goes like, man, like, you know, you're doing this all wrong. I'm thinking, okay, like, what are you talking about? How am I doing this wrong? He's like, so he goes, you know, you have to put white down when you apply for these jobs. I'm like, that just doesn't make any sense, because I am from Montgomery, Alabama, and I'm thinking, you know, I know racism when I see it. So I'm like, dude, there's no racism out here in Seattle. I haven't seen anything. So why am I even thinking about it? And so as we in the midst of having this conversation, I get rejected from another job. And so this kind of happened really out of spite. I just really wanted to just prove him wrong just so he can leave me alone. And so I was like, okay, well, let me reapply to this same job, just as white, just so you can leave me alone about this. And then so as we sitting there, we were actually playing Madden. And about 30 minutes, I get a email notification. And it's from the same company. Like, hey, you know, thank you for application. We would like to set up a 30-minute phone call interview with you. And I'm like, wow. And so that's what kind of spearheaded everything. And I was like, well, we can't really make this assumption off of one company. And that led me down the road to doing some A-B testing. And it was the results I just got back were just so mind-blowing, to where, I mean, literally every time I applied as black, I was rejected from the same job. And when I applied to white, 80% of the time, they wanted me to do an in-person or a phone interview. And so that kind of really just gave me the fuel to really want to go down this road and see, could I really do something about everything.
And what year was that, just to kind of level set? When was this happening?
This was about 2017, something like that, within the past three to five years. Like right before I actually started at SAS.
Okay. And what kind of companies were these? These were tech companies? And
yeah, these were majority tech companies. There were some like retail companies, but majority tech, retail, like just Seattle-based companies, from startups to like even like the big players as well too.
So how did you actually indicate, you know, race at that point in interacting with the company? Like, what was the, you know, was your picture on your resume? What was the difference between the A and the B test?
You know, like usually, like when you're filling out these applications, they have this optional boxes that you select, and they have all these things. And so I was opting in to fill out these optional boxes. And so that's how, I don't know if they use it or not, I just found the trend like very ironic that that's what happened. So maybe it was an ironic thing, I don't know, but I just find that hard to believe, like that's just ironically happening. But
right. But they're actually putting those boxes to try to source candidates that are diverse. And
so you usually have like, hey, this box is optional, you can decline to identify or select your race. And so every time I selected my race, I did black and then I did white.
So how did you internalize that? Like, what was the reaction at that point? You said, you know, obviously that motivated you ultimately to start a company, but before you got the notion of turning that into a company and trying to help solve that problem from one angle, what was your reaction to that?
My reaction was, I was shocked just because I was in Seattle. If I was in Alabama or you know, somewhere like that, it'd be completely different. I would expect that. But here, I just wasn't expecting it. So what I did was I said, okay, well, obviously there's something here. This is how racism plays out here in the Pacific Northwest, in this area specifically. So I said, so what could I do to really help others not really have to go through this same situation? Yeah, you know, I could have filed a lawsuit and done this, but then, you know, you get under gag orders, you can't talk about it, and that's just not who I am. I'm just like, okay, well, what could I really do? And that really made me think about, you know, my upbringing, growing up in the Deep South, experiencing all these racial things that I experienced growing up. And I was like, a lot of these things could have been avoided with a conversation. And I was wondering, you know, where was I being judged before you even had a chance to speak with me? And so I said, okay, so how could I really bridge that gap to help people have these tough conversations? Because it's really hard to have conversations, because everybody, when you're talking about sensitive topics, because everyone is afraid of something, like, oh, I don't want to offend anybody. Oh, I don't want people to know this is how I truly feel. I don't want people to think that I just not aware. And it's okay, you know, to feel that way. but you shouldn't also punish people at the same time just while you're trying to learn these things as well too. So I wanted to figure out a way that we could help people, you know, bridge that gap and make communication easier for people to talk about these sensitive topics. And I wanted to see if that was even something that was important in corporate America. So I started talking to a lot of employees and I started finding out there were a lot of similarities that I felt growing up and, you know, my voice being suppressed or me feeling like my voice was suppressed and I couldn't speak up. A lot of employees feel the exact same way within their company. Everybody has that reason why they don't tell the company the truth. They don't trust the company. Or like, hey, I just bought my house. I'm not trying to lose my job. I just put my kid in private school. Oh, I'm a woman. I'm just got an initial role. And I'm the first woman, so I don't want to mess it up for someone else. And those are the things that, you know, people deal with on a daily basis. And I wanted them to have a safe place to where they could come and have these conversations about the workplace without all this fear of backlash or judgment. And so that's how the inspiration kind of came from that correlation.
Yeah, because you had that experience and it's interesting. You chose not to reach out to the companies and right, because maybe that was uncomfortable, but then you found all these other scenarios that people were experiencing, maybe in recruiting or they already had jobs and they weren't comfortable kind of raising it to the company. How'd you go conduct that research? Like after your initial seed of, hey, I had this experience, you know, what were the next steps to go explore that problem more? Like how'd you reach out? What kind of questions were you asking?
First thing I did was I said, okay, well, how can I, is this even valuable? So like the way I look at try to solving problems and that sort of thing is I try to think of things from the negative space. So I try to disprove whatever is my theory. So I had this theory that, hey, you know, conversation could help bridge, you know, these particular topics, these sensitive topics. And so my whole theory was like, hey, let me go just disprove this whole theory and just say, like, people don't want to talk to each other and people don't want to try to get down to the core of things. And so as I made this negative hypothesis, then I came up with a subset of questions that I would ask people, you know, about whether it was their workplace, whether it was management and that sort of thing. So I came up with about three different questions that I would just ask people, and people would just start, you know, telling me all these different scenarios. And, you know, and I kind of, as an example, I used to use teaching all the time to where, you know, if it's like, if you want to make macaroni and cheese for a large party, right? The first thing you need to know is figure out like what ingredients I do not need. Like I don't need to make the macaroni and cheese just off of what you love and everything. I need to make it out. I need to figure out what you don't like. So at least I can then narrow it down and say, okay, well, these are the things I don't need. I can now have this subset of things to work with. And so I took that thought process right into doing my customer discovery and understanding the employees. And so through that process, that's when I started hearing people like, hey, you know, I don't trust the company. Hey, I just got a promotion. Hey, I just bought a house. Hey, you know, it was array of things. I mean, from even maternity to death, people were telling me about like how people died and they were taken off. They got the, you know, the standard, I guess, 14, 15 days off. But when they got back to the office, they just didn't feel like they could go back. They needed additional days, but they were afraid to ask for additional day after like a death of an immediate family member. And I'm just like, I was just so confused. I'm like, wow, I would have never thought of that. I would think that if someone died, it'd be like, okay, well, hey, I need a little bit more extra time. And whomever your boss is would be like, okay, like take a little bit more time, you know, so you can come back and be more productive. But, you know, it was some very interesting stories that people were sharing with me about why they didn't speak up and about why they felt like they had to go to work or all this pressure they were under. So it was very interesting.
What do you think was going on in the companies, if you could draw out any themes that caused that barrier to people raising issues about racism or other things, like you're saying, you know, death in family, other things that were impacting their happiness and their engagement at work, but they wouldn't raise it? Do you think there were clear themes and things companies were doing to cause that?
Yeah, I mean, my own personal opinion from the research is that I don't believe there is a true mechanism to where people can actually speak up without some type of fear. Like, so they're always going to have some type. Of course, you're going to have some outliers, people, you have some more vocal people that's going to always speak up. But those aren't necessarily the people that you need to be trying to reach, because they're going to be small and few between. It's the other 80% of the people that won't say anything. And then, you know, next thing you know, they're leaving for another job or, you know, whatever the case may be. And so, and it's hard to really make an environment like that just because of human nature. People are judgmental. So whether you make this environment like this or not, you still gonna have people who always think, like, if it came down to me and you getting a raise, I would think if I said something one day and everything was the same, I would think like you would get it because it's one little thing. And when you are part of this underrepresented group, you always have that in the back of your mind wondering, like, oh, was it this thing that I said that one time? Was that the thing that held me back from getting a promotion? And so those are going to always be things that happen in the workplace. I don't care how open policy it is, or, hey, you can say whatever. You can create that, but people still not going to trust that. Because now you still have, if you have a, you know, 1,000 person company, you're still going to have the other 900 people that could possibly judge you for speaking up about this one thing. And so whether you created this environment to say, hey, you can come in, you can say whatever. Yeah, you can, but you will be judged. And that's just human nature. And we all know that. So, like, I don't think, you know, that's going to be a surprise. But, you know, so, and that's why we wanted to create something where you could speak up and not necessarily have all these judgments, because I think that's just human nature, that people are just going to judge. I mean, that's what happened. You watch the news every day and, you know, you're judging somebody off of what the headline read. And so that's just going to be human nature.
Right. So the result of that fear and feeling that they'd be judged for raising these issues is people would leave their jobs, or what kind of outcomes were you seeing from it? Would they end up leaving their jobs and the company just wouldn't know, or they'd never get hired or leave during the interview process and the company would never know that these things were going on?
It was a combination of a lot of things. I spoke with a lot of people that were, you know, they were like, hey, they don't even know I'm applying to other jobs. I'm leaving immediately. Like, you know, this place is just so toxic that I'm going to leave. Or, hey, I went on this interview and this is something that I went on a couple interviews with different companies, but when it came down to treatment, I felt like I was treated better here than there. So I have these offers. I'm not even considering this company, but I wanted to have something in my back pocket just in case I got turned down from everywhere else. And so everybody has their own fears when it comes to that. So I feel like it's a lot of things, because even doing the exit interview, I found out a lot of people still won't tell the truth. Like, some people will, but a lot of people won't, because then you kind of ruin the relationship if you really tell what's going on or what happened to you. And it's like, okay, well, I'm leaving anyway, so, but I might have to use you for a future reference. So I want to make sure the relationship is still good when I leave. So you still might not find out why, the real reason why I left.
Right. It's interesting, because even if the company really wants to uncover those things and try to solve any systemic problems, they're not, like, the loop is never being closed on so many of these things, right? So then they may have the best intentions, but then that just keeps kind of perpetuating.
Absolutely.
What's your take on the conversation about diversity and equality in tech now? I mean, specifically, you know, there's been a lot more attention raised here, obviously, in recent months. What's been good about that, and what do you think is missing in that conversation?
I think the good thing about it is that there is a lot of awareness and a lot of people are talking about it. The bad thing about it is, what are the tangible, actionable items that's going to come along with it? A lot of people are like, hey, we're going to put money towards diversity. But, hey, you know, we need something. We need to hire DEI. But I don't think the solution is to hire a DEI. How about hiring more people in management that are experienced, that come from a different background? So I think those are the type of things that needs to happen, because, you know, you kind of think of it like about the Cobra effect, right? You're familiar with the Cobra effect, right?
I'm not. You got to educate me.
The Cobra effect is actually something I took away from the teacher's at SAS. Like, literally, like, she was talking about this Cobra effect. And I was like, okay, that's very unique. And so anyway, but the Cobra effect was about the outbreak of King Cobras in, I think, India. So they wanted to figure out a way to solve this King Cobra problem. So they started paying people to bring in King Cobras, dead King Cobras. And so the government was paying people. And by them paying people, people start breeding King Cobras to go take them to the government to turn in to get paid. And so the government started losing money. So they ended the program and everybody turned their King Cobras loose. And so they actually tried to solve the problem, but they made it worse. And so I think like that has the potential of happening without some type of tangible, actionable items. If they don't say like, hey, we want to improve diversity, not like by how many black employees or women employees that we hire, but can we get some type of tangible measurement to say, okay, we want to, you know, promote, you know, minorities within this particular, because what happens is when you start promoting people that don't look like you in these positions, you also bring their networks. So once they actually get in a position of power, now people actually see people that look like them. Now you inspire others to apply for this, for their actual role. But when I look at your company and I don't see anybody look like me, I might apply, but then I might apply for a lesser role because I don't think I'm able to reach this particular level. So I believe like those are some of the things that need to start happening, but I don't know, you know, I haven't seen anything about any tangible reports. I've seen a lot of money and a lot of talks about DEI specialists and said, hey, we're going to commit $100 million. But I'm like, okay, that doesn't necessarily translate to bringing in more diverse candidates. So that's what's something that I would like to see.
Yeah. So you think it really starts in kind of recruiting and career pathing then is one natural place. Are there any other areas that come to mind as gaps or places that companies should be talking more about this?
Yeah, I think it should just be within the structure of the company. I feel the company should be built on a fair role. Like, you know, when you're talking about these particular roles, a lot of times you don't have to go out and search for all these things. A lot of people are already employed at your company and they're just waiting for opportunity. And so I believe it's just giving those type of people with the opportunity, because a lot of times, most of the time, you're hiring on potential anyway. Like whatever role it is that you're hiring for, you know, like you're usually hiring, okay, like we know you're competent, otherwise you wouldn't be here for an interview. So now it's like, you know, I feel like a lot of people hire the same type of people. Like, you know, it's this question that always gets asked, like, are you a person that wants more than enough, not enough, or just enough? If everybody's on your team, if everybody wants more than enough, like you shouldn't have everybody thinking the exact same. And so I feel like a lot of times that's what happened. Like, oh, you went to Ivy League school. I'm not knocking Ivy League schools or anything like that, but that's usually a big indicator. Like, oh, you went to Harvard, you went to Stanford. Okay, that's a good thing. And boom, we'll ping you, you know. But if you didn't go to one of these elite institutions, then it's like, okay, well, if it came down to 50-50, now it's like I'm going to lean a little bit towards, you know, the Ivy League school than this school. But this person is just as capable or probably more, you know. And so, but you don't get that opportunity. And so I feel like giving people, being able to identify those people that can make change. And there's a lot of people within the organization that can make that change. So, I mean, everybody always go to recruiting. I feel like recruiting is just a piece of it. But what about the people that are already there that have been, you know, just waiting for their opportunity? Because you have people just waiting. Like a lot of people try to stick around and wait. And that's another reason why people leave. Because like, okay, well, I'm not going to get an opportunity to get to this position. So let me go leave and go somewhere else. And so like that's something that I noticed even when doing the research, a lot of people like, hey, you know, I don't even want more money. I just want a new title to reflect my responsibility. And, you know, employers be like, oh, you know, we don't want to give you this new title because of whatever reason they come up with. And then they end up leaving. And so that's another thing. Like I said, like when you're looking in these leadership positions and you don't see people that look like you, that kind of discourages you.
It's so interesting how there's so many assumptions that are there and unsaid that sort of drive this on all sides. And as you were saying that, I was thinking, you know, what are the other shortcuts or quick checks that we might use as managers or leaders that cause us to mentor somebody or accelerate their path? Like you were saying, they went to a premier school or they did these things, which there may be bias in that, right? And you may not be thinking about it. But yeah, there's so many of those things that, you know, could probably shine a light on and that could actually be causing bias. Okay, so the company in you're a company that's trying to, you know, help with this problem space, right? I don't think you're claiming to solve all of these big issues in our world alone. But I guess I'm curious, you know, as you've been founding the company, have you seen others taking kind of private business-driven solutions to this as well? And, you know, are you seeing more activity in the general area? Because I know you've been at it for a little while, but, you know, are you finding others that are like building businesses to help address this?
That's a really good question. I think a lot of people have been trying to solve it a lot of different ways. I think that's probably a better way to say that. Like I started, you know, you see a lot of consulting firms like really coming up and making a lot of change and doing a lot of work in the space. So I feel like that's where a lot of the solutions have come from to say, okay, well, you know, you can hire this consulting firm or this agency or this, you know, and they can come in and, you know, diagnose you with this particular, you know, kind of help you put a plan in place. But I want to say that there's been a lot of solutions geared around just giving the employee free reign and free voice and freedom to speak their mind, you know. So I feel like the problem's been solved a few different ways, and that's a great thing where, you know, you have a few different outlets to solve this problem. But I wouldn't necessarily say a lot of people like try to solve it in this particular way. I think it's more so the traditional way, like, hey, I can help you, you know, have this solution for diversity, equity, and inclusion, more so than say, hey, I just want to help you get the conversations going. And I feel like hopefully we can be the piece that consultants come to and say, okay, well, you can actually get your employees to use this platform, and now we can actually know what's going on in the workplace, and now we can actually bring you solutions. So I look at our tool as more the awareness driving piece, more so than the, like, hey, here is a mapped out 10-step process that you need to go through. And so I feel like that's where a lot of people are now, more so like, hey, I can give you the solution to help you do these things. And I want to be on the way to, you know, like, kind of be like the awareness, like when you go to a doctor for a checkup and you get your colonoscopy and you get all of these things, I would want to be that. So that way, when you get diagnosed, you have a legitimate plan that you can put in place and you could just turn on, you know, a turnkey solution, just say, okay, well, we already know what's going on, so let's go ahead and try to make some changes.
Right. So you're seeing companies basically flying a little blind on this in terms of data or insight or qualitative feedback of any kind that could guide their investment.
Absolutely, because it's more what I've seen is it's more like, hey, I want you to come do this test on my specific department, and then based on that, I want you to give me a solution, more so than, hey, and these solutions, you know, like, they vary, but I was like, you know, it's something that's missing about the solution piece, because before it gets to let me hire the consultant, something had to happen. But I just feel like like you were saying earlier, you're so far behind. By the time you get in front of the problem, get the solution, it's like this solution is 6 months too late. you know, the thing that people were caring about, this was 6 months ago. People caring about new things now. And so you coming in, you bringing this training, but it's like, we don't need this training. We needed that 6 months ago, but okay, we're going to have to go through it because it's company mandated. And so we wanted a way to where you can actually keep up and keep, you know, stay up to date in real time, day to day, without having to wait 6 months for annual performance or, you know, these check-ins, like, hey, we're doing these check-ins, you know, every quarter or whatever the case may be. Because if you're checking in a quarter, it's too late. Like, what happened at the end of this quarter, it could be a whole new subset of problems that you missed. So we're hoping that we can kind of catch things before they actually become these big bubbling up topics.
Yeah. Well, I work with a lot of marketers. So I think in terms of campaigns versus programs, right? You're kind of turning it from this campaign, like something you do once or once in a while, to this kind of ongoing real time feedback loop. What was the first version of this? I think I read that it was just a forum or you put something out there. Tell me about how you like scraped together that very first implementation to get some validation on like people being willing to share and that the insights were useful.
Well, the very first version, it came from this application that I put out. It was called Anonymously Ask a Minority Anything. That's where like the origin of it came from. And then I just sent it out to a few friends and see what could happen. And then Amazon ended up finding out about it. And some people that I knew there, they connected me with some people. And they were like, hey, you know, we want this thing. We, you know, like it's something that we can talk about. And then I was like, well, wait a minute. I don't know. I didn't think about a business because my whole thing was like, I just wanted to give people a voice. And the initial premise was like, okay, well, I wonder if people could ask minorities anything. Like, would that be something? It was kind of funny, some of the questions that we got. So it was like very, very funny. And then, so that's what kind of started the process. And I had this employee data. And then I started to see that companies were interested in this type of information. And so I just started digging a little deeper. And then we knew that the anonymous piece had to be a part of the platform, but I just didn't know how to make it be anonymous without saying anonymous. And so I said, well, how could we make it to where it's trustworthy, is, you know, you remove all these hierarchy and all these fear, and it's just like you put everybody on the same platform, on the same playing field, and ended up taking that anonymous piece from that app I did, and started looking at how people were chatting, you know, like the Slacks. And then I started seeing it, and I said, okay, well, it has to kind of look and feel. It has to be like a community type of conversation. And so we just started to make it into a product. And, you know, that anonymous piece turned into like, hey, we're going to change your username every day. Like, you're a new person. And so that's how we reinforced that piece. And then we start getting feedback. People like, hey, you know, I like it. And the first versions were very, looking back on it, like not something I'm super proud of today. But at the moment, you couldn't tell me there was a better product on the market. But today, looking back, I'm like, wow, like what a difference a year makes. And so that's where it started coming from. And then people just started giving me feedback, and then I started tweaking it, and then we got into a good space, and we're like, we need to have it be our own. And that's what kind of, we just focused more on the product, and, you know, it brought us here today.
I know you're in the very early phases of this. So what's next? What's the next big kind of milestone or step that you're taking with the business?
So the biggest thing that we're working on now is we recently launched this series called Speak Your Truth. And it's a series to where we partner with select professionals and let them pick a topic that they truly care about and explain like why they care about this topic. And then we schedule a time and they come and bring everyone to our platform. And so for 30 minutes, you have this fully open forum text conversation about this particular topic. And so that's something that we're working on now. We launched our first soft one last Thursday. We have another one this Thursday. So we do it every Thursday. And so that's something that we are really focusing on right now, bringing awareness to that and having these conversations. The last week, the conversation was about mental health in the workplace. This week is about neurodiversity. So it's been some very good topics that people have been saying that they want to talk about, from mental health to neurodiversity to allyship to women. It's like a whole bunch of topics that we have coming. So I'm excited about that Speak Your Truth series.
How have you seen that spark additional conversation in your community kind of after the event itself? Has that led to interesting threads and people kind of bringing up their own issues or unrelated experiences, or what's been the outcome of those?
That's something that a lot of people were saying, like, well, from our first one anyway, that, you know, like, hey, you know, I was in here, but then I started just discovering the other things that's going on in the platform, and found myself making a comment on other posts that were already existing. Because what we wanted to do is, you know, now everybody is doing like Zooms and that sort of thing, and I feel like everybody is tired, like, you know, Zoom fatigue is, you know, you want to do an event, I got to watch an hour event. And so how this Speak Your Truth series came about was, I noticed that, you know, when you think of a podcast, fireside chat, town hall discussion, or any type of event, is usually like, hey, one-to-one, like me and you, we sit here and talk, and then the audience listens. And, you know, a lot of times the audience want to participate and they have these questions that they want to ask, but yeah, I can submit my question, but my question probably go unasked. And so we wanted a way to be inclusive to all, because even as a podcaster or as the host or the fireside chat leader, you still are politically correct in your responses as well too. And so, like, not only do you get to be anonymized, like, as the actual host, now you actually have your freedom to speak your truth about this particular topic. So now you get to raise awareness about the truth, and you don't have to worry about, like, hey, here goes Ask Me Anything, and a million people are waiting to see what Adam is going to say to this particular question. And that just goes back to what you were saying, like what you asked me earlier about what can the companies do. There's really nothing you can do, because if I voice my opinion and a million people hear my opinion, I'm going to get judged by somebody. So, you know, it's that type of fear that, you know, doesn't allow people to really voice their opinion, because they don't want to risk losing. Because if you say something that does not agree with the company, I don't care what company you are, if it becomes very toxic for the company, I'm pretty sure you're going to be asked to leave. It's going to be some talk that you're going to have with HR, an executive, or somebody. So, you know, it just goes back to that. And so I felt like this was a good way to get that dialogue started with people and get topics that they care about and out to the public.
That's cool that you've pulled that principle about how to properly facilitate the anonymous conversations to happen, not just in the kind of community forums, but also with kind of AMAs or speakers coming in. I hadn't realized that's a super interesting evolution. And what's next for the business? Can anybody sign up now anywhere in the country, or are there any constraints, or is the community able to grow kind of organically wherever somebody might be that could find value in this?
There's no constraint. So we made it open to the public. We made it to where a Quora kind of meets Reddit a little bit. So it's open to the public. So the only thing you have to do is come to inyour.com, create a profile, and you can start contributing to communities. You can create your own community. You can create a public or private community. So even if you just want a community for, you know, your team, you can actually come in and create a password protected community and share that password out with, you know, limited individuals. You could change that password whenever you know, as many times as you like as well too. So we tried to make it to where it was easy to access and made it available to everyone. So that was our really goal, because the whole mission is to just give professionals a voice. And so as you come in and you actually can have that voice and talk about these sensitive topics in a real safe and secure environment.
Well, looking forward to watching that journey. I want to wrap this up, Sydney, with the Supersonic Six, your rapid fire round. So, number one, who's one Seattle business leader that you're following or learning from right now?
Well, I have a couple of mentors that I've been learning from Bob Bagger from BizX and Dr. Randeep Singh. He's a neurologist over at Overlake. I know it's like two different careers, but they played a very critical role in helping me get to this point. And then another leader I just enjoy watching is Kabir Shahani at Imperity, just to see, like, because I've known him and seen the company grow from when they raised the initial round into where it is now. So that's been great to sit, you know, and sit back and watch and, you know, been able to pick his brain here and there.
Number two, what's one Seattle company you're following or learning from right now?
I would say Imperity, just because I've seen them grow from the actual small stage into, you know, what they are now. I think they just raised like a 50-something million dollar round recently. So that was, you know, it's just been exciting just to watch them grow and, you know, and go through the process and see what that process is, and to have the ability to have conversations with the founder, with Kabir, to talk about a little bit about that every once in a while. So it's just been good to know that I can call them and ask them a couple of questions if I need to.
Number three, what's the one thing that Seattle needs to improve as a startup hub?
I would say access to capital, early stage capital, like angel money. So that's what I would think. And I think that's pretty consistent with what a lot of reports been coming out saying too. So, because I don't think there's a shortage of talent or anything like that here, but I do believe that capital is not as free flowing as other, you know, major tech hubs in the super angel stage. It's a little tougher here.
Number four, what's one piece of advice you'd give your 20-year-old self?
Oh, man. Whew, 20. My 20-year-old self, I would say, you know, think more long term. Like, you're going to live longer than what you expect. So think more long term.
Number five, what surprised you the most about building your business?
The thing that I would say surprised me the most is how willing everyone is around me to help once I actually got started. You know, I think that's the toughest thing, is just to actually get started. And once you start going on the journey, people are willing to help you get to that next step. You know, they may not understand what you're doing, but they can at least offer resources or offer advice. And I feel like that was the most surprising thing about this process, about how many people that I've run into and how many people that I know personally that was like, hey, you know, I can help you, or have you thought about this, or hey, I can, you know. So I think that's the interesting part.
I like your insight too about that it was once you got started, because there's a lot of ideas and people who talk, right? But that first step of taking action, you know how big that one is, and I think others know. Then they know that you're serious, right? Number six, what can this community do to help you?
I think you should go to InYour, register, sign up, and start having some conversations, join in some other conversations. Just get familiar with the platform. That's what I would say.
And it's just simply InYore.com. Well, Sydney, thank you for your time. This has been fun.
Thank you. Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Is it on? I think it's on. Hey, it's Adam again. Quick note before you go. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you're enjoying the show as much as I am enjoying making it. If you do like it, please leave a rating or a review. That would help other people find it in Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And if you have any feedback, send me an email, adamseattlepodcast@gmail.com. No underscores, no periods, just adamseattlepodcast@gmail.com.